This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. Russia shook up its top leadership in charge of its faltering invasion of Ukraine on Wednesday after months of battlefield setbacks. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zelina reports.
According to Russia's defense ministry, Chief of the General Staff Valery Gerasimov will take over as top commander. The move makes Gerasimov directly accountable for what Russia calls its special military operation in Ukraine. It's a demotion for General Sergei Serovikin, who's nicknamed General Armageddon by the Russian media for his reputed ruthlessness. He was in the job for just a few months. In a statement by the defense ministry, they said the reshuffle was meant to improve contacts between different military branches and the quality and effectiveness of the command structure.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Zelino. The top national security officials from the U.S. and Japan have unveiled plans to strengthen the alliance to help counter threats from North Korea and China, which they called the greatest challenge in the region.
And I want to reaffirm the United States' ironclad commitment to defend Japan with the full range of capabilities, including nuclear.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, as U.S. and Japanese foreign and defense ministers agreed at their meeting Wednesday in Washington to adjust the American troop presence on the island of Okinawa. But Secretary of State Antony Blinken also said the agreement reflects the two nations' effort to deepen cooperation, quote, across all realms, including space, cybersecurity, and emerging technologies. Protests against Peruvian President Dina Boluarte's government that have left 47 people dead since they began a month ago are spreading through the south of the Andean country, with new clashes reported in the tourist city of Cusco. This is VOA News. Brazilian authorities spared no effort to boost security in the face of a social media flyer promoting a mega protest to retake power in 24 cities. Whether because of the preventative measures adopted or not, the supposed uprising was a dud. Less than 10 protesters showed up along Rio de Janeiro's Copacabana Beach. There were more journalists in attendance as well as 29 police vehicles. Tigray forces who fought a two-year war against Ethiopia's federal government began handing over heavy weaponry to the National Army as part of an African Union-led peace process on Tuesday. Reuters correspondent Trevor Correll reports.
The handover, around 20 miles northeast of the regional capital Mekele, was overseen by a monitoring team made up of members of the two sides and a regional body, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development. The demobilization of Tigray forces who fought a two-year war against Ethiopia's federal government is seen as central to the November 2nd ceasefire agreement, along with the restoration of services and resumption of humanitarian aid.
Reuters correspondent Trevor Carroll. The White House says U.S. First Lady Jill Biden had two cancerous lesions removed on Wednesday. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Doctors at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center removed the cancerous lesions from above the 71-year-old First Lady's right eye and her chest. President Biden's doctor says both are confirmed to be the most common type of skin cancer and the most curable. It grows slowly and seldom becomes life-threatening. A third lesion on her left eyelid was being examined. The president went to Walter Reed with the First Lady this morning and spent much of the day there. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Injured American football player Damar Hamlin has been released from the hospital. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
More than a week ago, Hamlin suffered cardiac arrest after making a tackle during a game in Cincinnati. His doctors in Buffalo say they completed a series of tests. Sean McDermott is Hamlin's coach.
Grateful first and foremost that he's home and with his parents and his brother, which is great. I'm sure it's felt like a long time since he's been able to be home.
The doctors who treated him in Cincinnati say it's a remarkable recovery. The Bills are preparing to host their division rival Miami Dolphins in a wild card playoff game Sunday. McDermott says it will be up to Hamlin if he wants to visit the team. I'm Ed Donahue.
The U.S. aviation sector was struggling to return to normal on a Wednesday following a nationwide ground stop over a computer issue that forced a 90-minute halt to all U.S. departing flights. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Today is Thursday, January 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinny Adolfo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Ukraine denies Russian forces control the strategic salt mining town of Soledar.
Russian and Ukrainian forces were engaged in intense fighting on Wednesday over the town of Soledar in eastern Ukraine.
Ethiopia says the ground forces are handing over heavy weapons as part of a peace deal.
Ethiopian Federal Defense Force in a statement Wednesday confirmed Tigray forces have started handing over heavy weapons, the latest progress in line with the November peace deal.
And protesters clash with security forces as anti-government protests continue in Peru. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukraine denies that Russian forces control the small salt mining town of Soledar, where fierce battles rage despite the claims of Wagner Russian mercenaries. Seizing the town is part of Moscow's plan to take Donbass. Lucy Fielder of Reuters has more.
Russian and Ukrainian forces were engaged in intense fighting on Wednesday over the town of Soledar in eastern Ukraine, a stepping stone in Moscow's push to capture the entire Donbass region. The Russians appeared to have the upper hand. Moscow's defense ministry said airborne units had cut off Soledar from the north and south. And the mercenary group Wagner, which has spearheaded the assault, said on Tuesday it now controlled the small salt mining town despite pockets of Ukrainian resistance in the center. But Ukraine's military denied Soledar had fallen and said its defensive lines had not been breached. Reuters was able to verify the location of outdoor footage released by Ukraine's armed forces on Monday, but not the date it was filmed. It also purports to show Ukraine's Colonel General Oleksandr Sirsky speaking to soldiers in the region. Serhiy Sherevatyi, spokesperson for the Eastern Military Command, told Ukrainian television the intensity of the battles was reminiscent of World War II. And Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov stopped short of claiming victory, acknowledging heavy Russian losses. Victory in Soledar would have symbolic, military and commercial value for Moscow after battlefield setbacks in recent months and provide a base to intensify attacks on Bakhmut. Russian state media said Wagner had taken over the town's cavernous salt mines, which once produced salt exported to 20 countries. Photograph posted on Wagner's Telegram channel appeared to show the head, Yevgeny Prigozhin, and his fighters inside them. Reuters has been unable to independently verify the situation in Soledar because of the fierce fighting. But a Reuters photographer who reached the outskirts in recent days said many residents had fled along roads out of the town in perishing cold. They saw ambulances waiting and chaotic scenes in field hospitals.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters. And the U.S. Department of Defense has announced it will begin training military personnel from Ukraine on how to use and maintain an advanced air defense system Washington is providing to Kyiv. This story from VOA's Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
The United States has already promised a Patriot surface-to-air missile system to Ukraine, and now there is a need for the Ukrainians to learn how to operate the advanced equipment to thwart Russian missile attacks. Pentagon Press Secretary Brigadier General Pat Ryder told reporters on Tuesday that once placed in the field, the system will give Ukraine another capability to defend itself against ongoing aerial assaults from Russia.
Training for Ukrainian forces on the Patriot air defense system will begin as soon as next week at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. The training will prepare approximately 90 to 100 Ukrainian soldiers to operate, maintain, and sustain the defensive system over a training course expected to last several months.
The Ukrainians had repeatedly requested such a system from the United States to help them build layers of air defenses to intercept Russian planes, drones, and missiles. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Steve. And the UN's top human rights official warns the U.S. government's new border enforcement measure risks undermining people's basic rights to seek asylum. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Türk says he fears the new border policy will undercut the basic foundations of human rights and refugee law to protect the lives of people fleeing for safety. Türk's spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, tells VOA the High Commissioner is concerned the measures will lead to an increase in collective expulsions without having protection needs assessed individually. She adds that people who undertake these dangerous journeys are fleeing very difficult circumstances in their home countries. The new U.S. policy would allow some 30,000 individuals from Venezuela, Cuba, Haiti, and Nicaragua to come to the United States every month for a limited period of 2 years. Shamdasani says the High Commissioner welcomes the measures that would create and expand regular safe pathways for migration.
However, we are worried that these are very restrictive and that those who are most vulnerable and those who are most in need of asylum are unlikely to meet the requirements to be granted this humanitarian parole. For example, one of the requirements is that you have to have a financial sponsor in the U.S. Now, obviously, those who are most vulnerable will not be in a position to provide that.
Shamdasani says the announced changes to the so-called public health order known as Title 42 are also of concern. That policy, she says, will be expanded to include increased use of expedited removals of migrants from the United States. She says Title 42 will permit the fast-track expulsion to Mexico of some 30,000 Venezuelans, Haitians, Cubans, and Nicaraguans each month.
You may be aware that Title 42 has already been used some 2.5 million times at the southern border of the United States to expel people to Mexico or back to their home countries without an individualized assessment of their protection needs. This is of obvious concern to us.
High Commissioner Türk reiterated his call for the human rights of all refugees and migrants to be respected and protected at international borders. While there is a great deal of talk about migration crises, he says the reality is that it is those who are migrating who often are the ones truly in crisis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei had harsh words for protesters on Monday. In a speech in Qom, he said ongoing protests were acts of treason and blamed them on Western, Arab and Israeli incitement. Raoul Marc Grech is an analyst at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and a former media specialist at the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. VOA's Michael Lippin asked him on the phone how the protests have affected Khamenei's power base.
I would say that the inner circle, those that are close to the supreme leader, I think there is a fair amount of unity in that, you know, they view this as a life and death struggle. Outside of that very small circle, amongst those who once upon a time were actually close to the Supreme Leader, I think there's a much greater divergence of views. It's unclear where this dissenting opinion would go. I mean, the advantage the regime has is that if this is a life and death struggle, and I believe it is, then the opposition, I think, is unlikely to accept, you know, former senior members of the clerical regime into any type of new order. I mean, this is an evolving situation, but it does appear that the protesters are after not reform, but actually the end of the theocracy, the end of the Islamic Republic as we have known it. Needless to say, anyone who has risen high in the Islamic Republic would be in danger in that new order.
So what options does that leave the close circle of people around the supreme leader in terms of how to move forward and keep themselves in power?
Oh, I think they're going to try to kill their way out of it. They're obviously not trying to do it in a comprehensive way. I mean, if you were to compare the way they have approached these demonstrations with, say, 2019, they've been actually less violent. And they obviously are nervous about engaging in a great deal of violence in what you would call the Persian core of Iran. most of the casualties have occurred in the primarily ethnic provinces. Now, you have to be careful there, because even in the ethnic provinces, there's a great deal of ethnic diversity. But certainly, the worst violence appears to have occurred in Kurdistan and Balochistan. But I think the regime has clearly decided that they're going to turn up the pressure. They're selectively executing people. It certainly appears they're engaging in more torture and violence against those who have been arrested. So they're trying to ratchet it up and to see whether fear will do the rest.
What is holding the Iranian government back from taking deadlier measures in the Persian population centers of the country?
I think the primary concern is that they could provoke mass demonstrations. I think there's a concern, certainly when it comes to women, that elite families, their own daughters are protesting. So you could find that daughters of the clerical elite, of even the Revolutionary Guards, they could be, you know, killing their own daughters. So I think there's a real nervousness about too much violence in the Persian core. They really don't want to see mass demonstrations like they saw in the past in Tehran. So I think they're trying to, you know, nibble away at this with increasing violence on the edges to see whether, in fact, they can shock the system and basically get the dissent at least calmed down enough that they can, you know, operate the society adequately.
That's Ruel Magurecht, an analyst at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and a former media specialist at the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. He was speaking with VOA's Michael Lippin. In other news, authorities say a police officer on patrol was attacked and burned to death by protesters in the Peruvian region of Puno. This as the death toll from demonstrations in the wake of the dismissal of former President Pedro Castillo rose to 47. Jose Luis Sonko Quisepi was on patrol with a fellow officer in the city of Juliaca on Monday when a mob attacked them and later set fire to their vehicle. Prime Minister Alberto Otaro confirmed Sonoko's death, saying that one officer was tied up and beaten, and the other one was, quote, burned alive in his patrol car, unquote. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. China's new foreign minister, Qin Gang, had begun a five-nation tour of Africa aimed at bolstering Chinese-African ties. Qin, who had been ambassador to the U.S. until December, will visit African Union headquarters in Ethiopia before traveling to Gabon, Angola, Benin, and Egypt. Analysts say trade and investments are on the top priorities for both sides as China and the U.S. compete for influence in Africa. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed welcomed Qin Gang to Addis Ababa as the Chinese foreign minister began his week-long tour. After visiting African Union headquarters Tuesday, the Chinese foreign minister will go to Angola, Benin, Egypt and Gabon. David Munyai is the head of the Center for Africa-China Studies at the University of Johannesburg. He offers some insight into what Qin Gang and his host will discuss.
At AU level, there might be some issues in terms of the request by Africans for China to help on the issues of reform of the United Nations. The AU itself is going to get a seat within G20. And then number of other issues within multilateral institutions, and China is a permanent member of Security Council.
China's investment in Africa is focused on infrastructure and telecommunications. According to the Chinese General Administration of Customs, in the first 3 months of 2022, trade between China and Africa reached nearly $65 billion. A 23% increase from the same period in 2021. Cliff Mboya is a researcher at the Afro-Sino Center of International Relations. He says economic revival will be at the top of most African countries' agenda.
What I expect him to address is China-Africa relations post-COVID. You know, we know that China is gradually opening up to the rest of the world, and they're trying to embrace the post-COVID world, which some of us have already embrace. So economic recovery will be key, and you must factor in the fact that there's a lot of renewed interest coming from the US and Europe. So China will want to put its stake in the relationship and just affirm African countries that it is here to stay and just to build on what it has.
Western nations have accused China of using massive loans for infrastructure projects to put African countries in debt to Beijing, both politically and economically. Rights groups say China also promotes corruption and ignores human rights concerns while seeking access to Africa's natural resources. Munyao says Africa are to blame for the corruption involving big projects in the continent.
My blame goes more on Africans, ourselves as Africans. I don't think we have clear laws and tough on corruption. The idea of blaming Chinese or blaming Americans on anything, it's not something that I buy into. There are issues, no doubt. Is there corruption in some of Chinese project? Yes. Is there any corruption in some of American project on Africa? Yes. How are we? What are we doing? And there is no one that we can say is better than the other. That's my own view.
Last month, the U.S. government hosted African leaders in Washington, where they agreed to support infrastructure projects on the continent, as well as invest in digital transformation, health, and telecommunications. Mboya says African nations will see if they can get similar or greater benefits from interaction with Xinjiang and China.
So he'll be received well, and the African leaders will be keen to see what he has to offer when it comes to his trip. So this trip, I know it will generate a lot of interest. The African Union, the leaders who are there, they will want to establish the personal contact with him just to get an idea of his ideas and his strategy and see how to align themselves with what he'll have to say or what China intends to do going forward.
In Egypt, the foreign minister is scheduled to meet with the Secretary General of the Arab League. The visit is set to conclude Saturday. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Ethiopia's military says Tigrayan forces have started handing over heavy weapons as part of the peace deal to end the two-year civil war. Maya Masika reports from Addis Ababa.
Ethiopian Federal Defense Force, in a statement Wednesday, confirmed Tigray forces have started handing over heavy weapons, the latest progress in line with the November peace deal. The statement said the first round of weapons were transported on Tuesday in Agula camp, 36 kilometers from Tigray's capital, Mekele. Ethiopian Army Commander Lieutenant Colonel Alamit Abdullah said the arms transfer included tanks, rockets, and mortars. The statement said observers from the African Union and various countries' militaries were present to verify the transfer from the Tigray People's Liberation Front. The confirmation came after TPLF spokesman Getachew Reda early Wednesday tweeted news of the handover. He said they hope and expect this will go a long way in expediting the full implementation of the agreement. The AU-brokered peace deal signed in South Africa saw the two sides agree the TPLF would disarm in return for restoration of aid and services to Tigray and withdrawal of foreign forces. The deal came after 2 years of devastating war that saw Tigray largely cut off from the rest of the world, hundreds of thousands of people killed, and millions displaced. The two sides have met a few times in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, to discuss implementing the deal. Since December, Ethiopia has allowed humanitarian aid to enter Tigray and restored power, water, banking, and telecommunications to the region. Witnesses say in late December, Eritrean troops who fought on the side of federal forces withdrew from two cities in Tigray. However, the TPLF accuses Eritrean troops of committing atrocities during the conflict and says they are still active in some areas of Tigray. Maya Misakur for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists exploring the late-stage merger of two galaxies discovered a pair of supermassive black holes they say is growing almost side by side near the center of what will become the combined galaxy. Until now, scientists have been able to only study the earliest stages of galaxy mergers. The observations were made with the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array in Chile. According to a press release from the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, a co-operator of the array, these voracious black holes are the closest together that scientists have ever observed over multiple wavelengths. They are currently separated by only 750 light years. The coalescing galaxy called UGC 4211 is located some 500 million light years away in the constellation Cancer. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including the concessions House Speaker Kevin McCarthy agreed to in a bid to appease conservative members of his party, set up showdowns this year with Senate Democrats and President Biden, possibly heightening the danger of a national default or a government shutdown. We'll have this and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Protests have been growing inside and outside Iran, initially sparked by the death in police custody of Mahsa Amini, a young woman arrested by Iran's morality police for not having her hair fully covered. Each Wednesday, go beyond the breaking news with VOA's Flashpoint Iran. Listen online at voanews.com or in your podcast player.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedofo in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State awarded four U.S. companies the Award for Corporate Excellence. Established in 1999, the award recognizes the crucial role U.S. companies are playing in showcasing high standards of business conduct in a variety of categories. Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Jose Fernandez, handed the first award to Intel for addressing the challenge of inequity. We all know that when we broaden access to economic opportunities, we help to unlock the full potential of our peoples and our societies, he said.
And that's what employees at Intel in Costa Rica have done, and that's what they wanted to do. They started a program for young people interested in STEM, focusing on students in the historically underserved region of Costa Rica, Limón. Through the program, young people can learn STEM skills like computer programming, improving their English, and finding internships in other tech companies.
The second award went to Drinkwell, a company that is helping supply Bangladesh with safe drinking water, announced Undersecretary Fernandez.
One of Drinkwell's founders developed a water purification system that's cheaper and what's more efficient, and it's easier to operate than other models. The company has also created a new delivery method, ATM-style machines that sell and dispense clean water in Bangladesh and are more accessible for people whose homes aren't connected to water pipes.
Gap in India is proving that they can do good business while also doing right by their employees and their communities, said Undersecretary Fernandez.
Throughout Gap's supply chain and across the country's apparel industry, Gap has implemented policies for their vendors to help prevent and address gender-based violence in the workplace. And they've also created training programs that have benefited more than 500,000 women and girls in India since 2007.
Anova, a company in Indonesia, received the final award for leading the way in producing seafood that meets high standards for quality and safety, and it's doing so ethically. These four companies are more than just places of business, declared Undersecretary Fernandez. They are champions of our country's highest principles and values and partners in tackling the most vexing global challenges in our time. And they're helping make real the vision of a world that's open, free, secure, and prosperous.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.